Hello and welcome to Intrepid Heroes Presents, a podcast where we chat about various topics related to role-playing games, typically Paizo products such as Pathfinder and Starfinder, but also others. With me today is Thurston Hillman, Paizo Starfinder Society developer. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome for having me. Blah. Hello and thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you here.
You can tell we're at the end of a convention.
Oh, yes. Yeah. How did you like this convention, by the way?
SkullCon has been one of my favorite conventions. I've been coming here since the second one. They invited me to the first one and I couldn't make it because I was doing a ton of freelance at the time. But every year since I've been down here as a guest.
Yeah, people talk this one up so much and it did not disappoint.
Awesome.
This is my first time here and I thought, definitely, this is like near the top of my list of where I want to go, and it's like my eighth convention this year, and it's like, no, this one is a must-have. So, Thirsty, may I call you Thirsty?
Absolutely.
All right. Thirsty, so can you tell me a little bit about your role, kind of what you do in this role, and also there's been some recent changes in your status. What happened there?
Yeah, sure. So so my role at Paizo is I am the Starfinder Society developer, which means I am the sort of dev in charge of Starfinder Society for the organized play program that we have. What I am responsible for is talking with freelancers and assigning them projects and then taking those projects in and working and massaging the text to make sure it fits in our world and our vision, and then making sure that those hit our publication and all of that fun stuff. So Paizo is sort of a company that has a lot of different people in it, a lot of different roles. My role is dealing with our freelancers and outlining and assigning them scenarios and then having them write those scenarios and me doing kind of the post work on them.
Right. So specifically the Starfinder Society scenarios. And so as the developer, you kind of build a overarching stories and maybe outline what each scenario might incorporate and then turn it over to a freelancer to fill in those more specific components?
Exactly. So one of the big things that I do for my role is writing outlines, which is like every society scenario we do, which is about like a 4 to 5 hour adventure, and we release two of those a month, is I write an outline for those, which kind of hits the high points and what we need the author to fill in. Those outlines get sent to an author with a contract and all that fun stuff. And then those authors will kind of do some back and forth with us to hammer down specifics. They'll send us in a milestone. And during that process, that's a lot of the communication I do is with freelancers. And then finally, once the freelancers finish their handover, they hand it over to me. And what I am responsible for then is taking that text and doing like a read through to make sure, okay, does this fit our world? Does this fit the organized play rules that we have? Does it, you know... Making sure that nothing that's getting in there is going to negatively, like, impact Paizo. Making sure that someone doesn't put in something not knowing, you know, maybe a hidden lore thing we have in the office.
Right, right,
and kind of just making sure it's going to fit in our setting. So that's a lot of what I do. Admittedly, I'm not an editor. We actually have separate people who will then go through and, look for grammar and spelling and that sort of fun stuff. So my thing is more the stories and the mechanics side of things.
And your role has morphed a little bit over this past year?
Yeah. So I started in the role of as a contractor for this position. I started off basically as a freelance contractor. Paizo kept me on for roughly 2 years. And then at the beginning of this year in January, Paizo was able to find a way to properly hire me full time through a company that I now contract for Paizo directly. So I am now able to be a Paizo employee and wear that blue shirt and all that fun stuff at events.
Right.
So.
And the difficulty was you're not actually located in Redmond with all those other folks.
Correct.
Yeah, you are in another country.
I am a Canadian. I live in Winnipeg, Manitoba, have all my life, but I managed to kind of work my way into this position, and after a while of doing it remotely and kind of proving that, okay, yeah, hey, we do have someone who can do a lot of this work remotely, then that was sort of how I stepped into the role and really took it over.
Well, you must be pretty well thought of, because I don't know of a lot of other people that are developers for companies that they're allowing for Paizo that work remotely. Didn't everybody else kind of work in house?
Yeah,
at the location.
I mean, predominantly we've had a few remote people in the past here and there. For developers, we've had some where it's been like maybe someone's left the company and they've kind of done some remote stuff for us for a bit. But in my case, it was very much a situation where when we were launching Starfinder, the company needed someone who knew organized play. I had a background in organized play from the Pathfinder side.
Right.
So And I mean, you know, you come into like a new game launch like Starfinder, no one knows how it's going to do. I totally understand it from Paizo's point of view. They kind of like, hey, we'll hedge our bets, bring in someone to maybe try this out, contract it remotely. You know, moving to Seattle is a big deal for a lot of people. Moving across country, between countries is a major big deal. Yeah. But so we kind of were taking it slow, but since Starfinder really kicked off, and I think I've had an okay handle on the campaign, it's worked out really well for both myself and Paizo in it.
So there's no moving you to Seattle then, it sounds like.
So my partner, she owns a family farm in Manitoba, so yeah. I think I would be murdered if that were to okay. ever happen. I love Seattle. I visit it often. So many of my good friends live there. It's just not in the cards for me.
Yeah, no, sure. I would ask.
Oh, of course.
So how did you get in this position? You kind of alluded to a little bit. You started off as a freelancer for Pathfinder, right?
Yeah, so I started off freelancing in the way, way back when machine for this little website some people may know called EN Worlds. Some people maybe know that. And they did a lot of 3.5 news at the time. Yeah. And I did an open call for, it was a contest for them for like, write us a little mini adventure for this adventure path they were writing. It was called War of the Burning Sky. And I wrote this little mini adventure. It was my first thing. It's awful. I sometimes go back and reread it and I'm like, what am I? But after that, Paizo had an open call for Pathfinder Society near the end of season one. And so I pitched, early season one, I pitched a scenario, and oh boy, did I get the best rejection letter. It was just like this is wrong. No, you don't want to use a rust monster in organized play that eats all their, equipment, like all this sort of stuff that happened. And, it was a very nice rejection letter, but it was also a rejection letter, that ended with a polite, like, okay, here's all the things you did wrong, but, like, you know how words work, so maybe, like, if you want to try this again, fix all these things. And I'm pretty stubborn, so I fixed all those things and sent it back and didn't hear anything for a few months. And then at the time, the developer, Josh Frost, contacted me. When I was in the United Arab Emirates for a work thing, I get this email being like, hey, how would you like to write this scenario for us? And that was 155, The Infernal Vault, which was my first thing I'd ever written for Paizo. And it kind of started a long relationship of me working on a whole bunch of products. I showed up at Gen Con following year for season two, for season three, I should say, 2 years later, because I was writing something that was coming out shortly after. I did a bunch of volunteering. I met a lot of staff from Paizo, got to know them. I ended up going out to PAX that year in Seattle and was running demos there. That's where I really first met Eric Mona. And like him and I like became friends after that. And, you know, Mark Moreland, Liz Quartz, all these people at Paizo who I just was meeting through conventions or hanging out. And so that was where I started with my freelance career. And that kind of eventually led to, you know, stepping up to a few other places, like getting into the adventure path line, the player companion line, the campaign setting line, you know, slow progress. I think the biggest thing I'd written for a long time was I wrote the season 5 interactive special, Siege of the Diamond City, which was kind of the first time we did like the big map for an interactive special and a whole bunch of like crazy things like that. And a couple years after that, I visited Seattle just to visit friends. I was out at the Paizo offices because, surprise, surprise, I knew a lot of people there and they were good friends. So I was hanging out in the office and I was offered a position from the editor-in-chief.
While you were there visiting friends.
Yeah. Wow. Wes Schneider offered me a job, and I kind of said, family farm, not moving. Sorry, Wes. That was many years ago. We kind of laughed about it, and what ended up happening was Starfinder came around, and at that point, just about a year before Starfinder, I was laid off from my job. I worked in IT. I was a project manager, and I was laid off and kind of like, all right, well, I guess I can get a new IT job. And my partner, she's like, you know what? How about you take some time, just do some freelance, relax a bit. And I did that, and then the freelance kept coming, and it kept coming. And sure enough, I was full-time freelance for about a year. And then Eric was like, hey, I want to talk to you at Gen Con. Let's have a dinner. And I ended up having dinner with Eric. And he's like, okay, we're doing this thing called Starfinder, as we've just announced 2 months earlier at PaizoCon. And we need someone to do the organized play campaign. How would you like to step into that role? So that's where it all kind of started. And then a couple months later, I was brought on as a contractor. And then, as I mentioned earlier, just in the last year, kind of full-time employee.
Wow, that's a great story. Actually, kind of lays out a path for people that are interested in development, you know, get started, do something, right?
Yeah.
Submit something, get to know people, go to conventions, volunteer. Do you have other advice for people if they're interested in becoming freelancers for Paizo?
Yeah, few things. I mean, I will go back to the comment you made about going to conventions, volunteering. That's not essential to get work from us. However, it really helps. And I'm not saying you have to be able to afford to go to conventions or afford to do all these events and fly around the world. But one thing that it does kind of help with, and this is how I got a lot of my work at one point, was I had actually asked, like, why are you signing me a whole bunch of stuff all at once? And I was said, well, because you show up to all these conventions, so I know you'll never, like, you'll never not submit something and then have to look me in the eye at a convention. You're going to, like, submit everything on time, because otherwise I'm going to see you in 6 months and give you a hard time. And like, a lot of the industry is small. Like, our freelancer pool is, we have a lot of freelancers, but it's still, like, overall a small community worldwide, comparatively to, you know, like, other large, crazy communities out there. But with our community, like, freelancers all know each other and talk to each other, and getting involved and putting yourself out there in those communities is really important, because you kind of build a name and a reputation for yourself by doing that.
Cool. So, switching gears a little bit, what's coming down the road for Season 2? We just kind of kicked it off here, and...
Yeah, Starfinder Society Season 2, we launched it back at Origins in June, the Year of 1,000 Bytes, as we call it. And the premise of this season was kind of a change in tone. Our first season for Starfinder Society, Year of Scoured Stars, I like to say it's like high epic space opera, Mass Effect kind of like building up a big group of allies and then punching some evil aliens in the face. Super good. This season we wanted to switch it up, because one thing we got overwhelming for season one was a lot of people really like the media aspects of Starfinder.
Yes, like, it seems like a lot of folks were really into the social media and the icons and all kinds of stuff. Yeah.
And so a lot of people were really jumping on that. So we kind of put together some ideas on, like, what would a season, like, not specifically about those topics, but like that is heavily steeped in those topics, right, be. And then we got to some specifics. And one of the things I really am excited for in season two is we introduce a villain in our first scenario, who is prominent throughout the whole season. And season one was a very epic storyline, as I said. Season two is meant to be a personal storyline for players to experience and kind of have that moment of, like, I have strong opinions one way or another on this NPC that we're introducing and some of the stuff going on. And so that's a struggle the society is dealing with, is this person is really amping up to mess with the society. And it starts with kind of like a social media smear campaign.
Right,
society has to do a lot of work to kind of maintain and repair their reputation and try to explain to people, like, just because we have, you know, world destroying starships doesn't mean that we're a bad group of people. Yeah. We're actually totally just explorers. And so we kind of like wanted to play on that a little, because there's a lot to say there. So that's one side of season two. And that's kind of like our core storyline is really delving into that and this villain we're introducing. The other part of it, comes into the scenario that we're releasing this month, 2-07, 4/1, written by, I don't know, some guy named Thurston Hillman.
Which is your first Starfinder credit?
Yeah, my first Starfinder Society scenario. Actually, it was on my like work performance review. I said I should probably write something for this game. Like, I've written for Starfinder and other products, but when you're the developer, it's really hard to write a scenario. Right. Luckily, Linda Zayas Palmer, the Organized Play Lead developer, after she took on the position, she's like, I really need to learn Starfinder. I'll dev Thirsty's scenario. And so she did the development on my scenario, which worked out great. But that comes out this month, and it's a very unique scenario, because what it does is it starts starting up the voting process we're going to have for the new First Seeker. And the First Seeker is kind of like our guiding leader of the society, a president of sorts. And so we're going to be taking four candidates for this position and introducing them to the player base in a series that are very much like our quests, like little bite-sized 45-minute to
like
an hour.
Like a quest pack, but for this specific
thing. We're stressing it's not a quest pack in that,
right,
like...
because they're all integrated and it's all one scenario.
It's all one scenario, but they are still like individual like adventures. They're very quest-like, but what we're saying is don't treat it like a quest pack where you have to kind of run through it or run one at a time. We want people to go through all... It's four candidates. We want people to go through all those adventures, but at the local game store, we understand. Like, sometimes you have 4 hours. Let's be honest. Sometimes you get in there, you bought chips, you're gabbing, you've got 3 hours to run a session. We really want people to know that with this this specific scenario, take that time. If you need to run this over 2 sessions, go ahead and do it.
Is it a replayable?
I believe it is.
Yeah, I think it
is repeatable. Yeah. Yes, it is repeatable. And it's very much a case of you're going to do stuff for these four candidates, mm-hmm. and we want to make sure each of them have time, because what we don't have is a situation where we're introducing this candidate and then we're blitzing through the final quest and nobody cares about the last candidate.
Right. All that would be bad, yeah.
Exactly. And so what we're doing is we're having you do these quests where you meet these candidates. And the cool thing about these candidates is that they're all from the player base. Each one of these candidates is a player character that an actual person in the organized play campaign made.
And how were they selected? What was that process like?
Yeah, so what we did was we introduced a, like, for our factions, they all had sort of, like, if you get to the top of this faction, you get a cool capstone thing. And for our kind of super dedicated Starfinders, they would typically serve the second seekers, which is the people under that president. Right? Mm-hmm. They're the people who really are just forwarding the goal of the society for that year. And so any of the people who reach the top of that faction, basically Luazi El Sebo, our current first mm-hmm. seeker, anyone who really reached that capstone, they got a cool little thing. But along with that, there was a email us at organizedplaypizer.com, send us your character pitch, and we'll review them. And so we didn't tell anyone what we're doing it for, and they're like, oh cool, maybe I'll be an NPC or something like that. And then we got the first batch of them, and we got about 25 to 30 entrants in mm-hmm. the first wave. These were dedicated players who'd really gone the mile, played a ton of sessions, and from them we kind of went through and we found 4 of them to be the candidates. And that was an internal selection process, just because some of them we couldn't use, sadly. Some of them might have, like, infringed on other IP or...
Because, the naming or
exactly.
Something
like that. Exactly. We had, a few that were named after, like, other sci-fi shows and that sort of stuff. And it's like, yeah, that's fun in like, casual games, but when we're doing something like this, we obviously have to be really careful as a company.
Right.
And so, yeah, we went ahead and we did... We toned it down to 4 that we thought were diverse enough and offered a lot of different options and were really evocative of the setting.
Mm-hmm.
And so we put those forward in this scenario. We contacted those 4 players, let them know, they gave us permission. One of those characters will then go on to become our new first seeker. And the way that this scenario works is that at the end of it, there'll be a poll that we're going to run for, I believe, 2 months. That's going to give people the time to play it.
So through November, end of November?
Yes. Right. It goes, the polling starts this coming Wednesday. Mm-hmm. Dates elude me at the moment. But, this polling starts then and then goes to, I think, mid to late November.
Right.
And then after that, we close off the polling and then we're going to get in touch with the person and we are essentially going to then start writing season 3 based off of that player's character.
So that person and their character will drive kind of the storyline somewhat?
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
Exactly. And so we
that's a lot of responsibility.
It certainly is. And, you know, it also was great because we got to talk about, like, man, when we show up at Gen Con, if we can convince that player to come, we'll just get them to sit
have
at the mic
stand. Have you met any of the players that have these characters yet?
So that was one thing that was really important to us when we did this process, was that we actually, when we did that internal vetting, it was done blind. So we didn't know the players that were involved, because it is a small community.
Right,
and we do know a lot of the high-end players. So when Tanya parsed them, she provided them to us with just the character names, just the background.
Right.
We didn't know who the player behind them
was. But you do now, though, right?
But we do now, and I don't want to say anything about it just
yet. No, that's fine.
But suffice it to say, we're really excited for the possibility of, like, what do you do if the first seeker is, like, the president's sitting at your table?
Yeah.
Also, then that raised some weird questions of, like, what happens if the president dies? Like, what happens if the first seeker dies in a scenario? What do we do? Just sort of fun stuff like that. But that'll kind of fuels back into, we want this to be a living campaign. Like, we want to really emphasize that living aspect.
So what other living aspects might come up besides this? Are there other things that you're looking at? Or
So one of the things is that with that second seekers, obviously we've kind of finished our decisions there, but we're going to still have that open, and in fact, starting in season 3, we're going to change it a bit so that all factions can now participate in that.
Oh, that would be good. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And at first we wanted to kind of focus on that one faction because it made sense with what society was doing and rebuilding and repairing. But now it was like, oh yeah, if the data files want to send a new person to be our boss, cool. But we're also looking at that for other positions too, like throwing in NPCs, like once we get some prominent players, like, hey, how would you like to be the mission briefer in a scenario or stuff like that?
Yeah, so maybe you're not at the top, but you get some other roles in the scenario.
Yeah, exactly. And we're playing around with that. One thing also about the living campaign that I'm a huge proponent of is I really try to follow what our community is up to and how our community is reacting to things. Again, like with season two, that entirely came just, we got so much positive reaction about media stuff. One thing, was like, we've had a lot of positive reaction on like the relationship between two of our faction leaders. And we've explored that a lot. Yes. And it's been really cool to like get that feedback and by coming to conventions like this, we really get that, and it's so just enjoyable to play.
Oh, so
off
that
of
so yeah, the initial relationship you all developed,
yeah,
but then all the subsequent mentions that was kind of driven from feedback.
And
oh,
we get
I didn't
some
know
feedback,
that.
And we get some like neat things. And for example, like when we talk about living campaigns and sort of how it can even impact the product line, like one of the neatest things I think we've done with Starfinder Society was in one of our early season one scenarios, Sanctuary of Drowned Delight, we introduced this species called Morlamaz, which can be described as psychedelic walrus people.
Right.
And it was like Kate Baker, who was the author, she did an amazing job. She pitched this to me and I was like, yeah, let's do it. And then our creative director found out about it afterwards and was like, whoa, 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 Thirsty, maybe we shouldn't have done that. It's a bit silly. And like, you know, like, hey, that's a valid criticism. but then eventually, like, I believe it was 2 months later, he came up to me at another convention and was like, psst, Thirsty, we're doing Alien Archive 3 and we're going to put in the psychedelic walrus people. And so it was like this really interesting thing where society had actually influenced what was going on in our...
As playable races
and what showed up in Alien Archive. Right. And then conversely, we introduced a race in one of our scenarios, the Izzelgoons.
Right.
And this was a great example of that living campaign. We introduced them in a scenario, and one of the key points of that scenario is there's kind of this... like Wakanda-esque, like they're these super technologically advanced people who kind of keep that hidden from everyone. Like they buried their starships. They're enjoying being farmers. Like they've left that life behind. And the PCs can find this out. And when they do, they have this option of, do we sell them out for money? Like basically sell them to National Geographic and have them like do ops on this like species. Or do we keep the secret? And when we wrote that on our chronicle sheet, which is like the thing you get at the end of each of our scenarios, we said like, yeah, you can totally sell them out for money. But if you don't sell them out, you get nothing extra. Mm-hmm. And it was this really funny thing internally where we wanted to see like if we gave the players a motivation to be kind of jerks, if they would go for it.
Right, right.
And we were astonished when the player base, like almost unanimously, was, well, no, we're not selling them out. That's not the kind of people we are. Mm-hmm. We're a good organization, which was great because one of the things we'd kind of plotted was when we put this seed in, we're like, okay, and if the players exploit them, like 6 or 8 months from now, when we knew the Izzelgoons were going to be a playable race, if the player base like basically sold them out, they would never be playable in Starfinder Society because they'd never work for the Starfinder Society after what happened. But instead, they're always available now because you guys are actually pretty reasonable. Right. And that was such a neat living campaign component where the player base made this decision and then it had some big ramifications down the line.
Oh, cool. So after Four for the First, we have a two-parter coming out.
So 208 is actually the second part of our first two-parter, The Stumbling Society, which is a kind of an interesting one that takes us to a place called Sangoro's Bulwark, which is this big, big base of operations for the Exo-Guardians faction, who are kind of like our space crusaders. And that was kind of where they kept all the nukes, and they sort of lost the location of it.
They lost the nukes.
And like, you know, when we're going through a media smear campaign, we realized maybe we should check the nuke closet to make sure that the nukes are still there. And that's what that scenario kind of deals with. And it's a two-parter because at the first part, there's kind of a big revelation. And the second part goes into some aftermath of that. And I think it's really exciting to see where that's going to lead.
Yeah, I really look forward to that. I really love the APs. And the one thing about the scenarios is you get into a story and then, oh, it's over.
Yeah.
And so I asked about this a while ago about having a multi-part, and I'm really excited to see a multi-part scenario, especially a 5-8, where you have characters that are relatively high level and they're kind of gaining really cool stuff, and now you get to continue that storyline. So I think that would be really fun.
Yeah, and season two is unique in that, like, the whole season's kind of like a story like that. You have sort of these self-contained adventures, but with the presence of us introducing this NPC, this villain of sorts, you really see a lot of connectivity throughout all our scenarios. Even if it's just like a mention of this NPC in the background, it makes it feel more alive, and that's what we're going
right,
for.
Right, so in contrast to season one, you had mentioned earlier that this whole season two, you've already kind of outlined it all the way through to the end, and so you have a much tighter story arc way across.
And so with season one, we certainly knew the key beats we wanted to hit. We'd outlined like the season pitch, which we do every year. But with season two, I actually had the opportunity, because I managed to claw some time back after before Gen Con, I managed to outline the entire season, each of the scenarios. So like there was a lot of moments where I could put connectivity between different scenarios and so that authors could get in touch with one another
together. That's great.
And so like, for example, with 206, the first of the two-parters, Sengoro's Lament, that's written by Mike Kimmel, who worked really closely with the next author, Kendra Lee Speedling, who she was able to get a whole bunch of information from Mike, and they were able to play off of that. It worked really well. And so we're doing that, but on a broader scale this season overall, where some authors are like writing things for scenarios that haven't been written, that follow scenarios that haven't been written yet. And so they're all kind of collaborating in a lot of ways. And that's been really cool.
And another interesting thing that's coming down the road in December is our first scenario that goes beyond level 10.
Yeah. Our first 9-12 data purge. Oh boy. One of the tricky things with Starfinder Society is because we have our level ranges, we want to make sure that every year is kind of like a pyramid, that we have a solid like base of low level so new people can come in and experience the stories and people can build new characters. But every year we're kind of adding higher and higher tiers to this to this pyramid to make sure that like we can support our players. And I am a firm believer of getting us to 20th level by the time I'm done.
I'm very excited to hear that now. That is great.
And that's kind of my like been my personal mission since I started. And so Data Purge is another step there. It's our 9-12. It is summed up best as a breaking into the Lore Spire complex, and which is the base of operations of the Starfinders. And why would a group of Starfinders need to do that? And why would it be such a high level thing? Yeah, so that one is coming up. It's going to be written by a pretty veteran author of Pathfinder Society and Starfinder Society, Cole Kronawitter, and we're really excited to see how that's.
Well, I'm excited for these upcoming scenarios coming down the road.
Cool. We have a couple. I mean, like one internally was just in November was originally called Kaiju Heist, but we kind of had to rename it. It's Colossi Heist. Yeah. And you can probably put together some fun things that might come out of that.
Nice. So with the Starfinder Society getting a little bit age here into its second season, what advice do you have for new players looking to just get started now in Society? Where should they start? Should they jump in season two? Should they start from the beginning?
I would say whatever feels natural. One of the cool things about organized play is you can handle it however you're comfortable with. And a lot of it is drop-in gaming at local game stores. So if season two is running, we try to make everything approachable in the scenario. So is someone coming in now with season two just starting, really? You can go to that local game store and catch up on some of those scenarios, get some of that key information. So one of the things I always say when people want to get into organized play, I always say go down to your local game store. See what's running. If they're running Starfinder Society, if they're running Pathfinder Society, or just organized play in general, I should say. But for Starfinder Society in specific, if no one's running, I would suggest jumping in and doing what you feel right. There's no, you have to play season two as it's releasing. I mean, certainly we want people to, but if you want to go back and pick up our season one content and start there with your group and go through that whole story arc, you certainly can. I know a lot of people who what they do is they play our seasons like they're a campaign now. So,
Well, so what's next for Thirsty? What are big picture things going down the road?
Oh, big picture things. Wow. Well, as I said, Four for the First just finished up. It's kind of funny right now. I'm actually kind of taking my break. I've done a lot of freelance over the past few years. What's next for me coming up though is I've doing some projects for some other companies.
Sacrilegious.
I know. I'm working with some properties I'm really excited for. I'll be announcing some stuff on that down the pipe, but I'm pretty excited about that, like branching out. And it's nothing against Paizo. I love the company I work for. I am doing a ton of freelance for them coming up too. It's just taking a bit of a break for a while just to kind of recool personally, kind of recenter myself after the convention season. We're just coming to the end of what we consider like the high point of convention season, PaizoCon Origins, Gen Con, Skull Con. I'm actually taking a vacation. My vacation starts right after this interview because this is my last official thing on the con.
Wow. Okay, well.
No, you're fine. You're fine. But so for me personally, we're really excited to see what's coming with 4th and 1st in the voting. We're really excited to start digging into some of season 3. Like starting to piece that puzzle together. So one of the things that I'm kind of a weird neurotic nerd for is that I tend to write massive 5-year plans. So I kind of know what season 3 is going to be from a, like, here's a concept and we can slot our new first seeker into that concept and make them both work. But I really try to have a firm hand on the story so that people have really jumped into how we have a lot of continuity in Starfinder Society and a lot of like little nods or Easter eggs towards future things. And I'm really trying to steward that and keep that process going without, you know, scaring away new people, which is a concern. So that's kind of my immediate plate right now. Otherwise, there's some stuff coming down the pipe with sanctioning. We're going to be working on sanctioning, you know, Alien Archive 3, the Character Operations Manual.
That'll be sanctioned right when it hits, right?
I'm hoping.
You're going to be on vacation. You're going to be working.
I'm working right after my vacation. I can tell you the pre-gens are pretty much done now.
Excellent. That's exciting. And we'll have some level 12s too?
Nope.
No.
That's something to look for down the pipe. I think with that, it's kind of it's always priorities, right?
Oh yeah,
it's always a matter of like how much bang for a buck. And I think, you know, higher level pre-gens are useful. It's like, okay, do we do that or do we sanction all the comm stuff? Sanction all the comm
stuff.
Stuff. Need all those those great rules. So that's kind of where I'm looking at for the next few months. And
Well, awesome. Well, thanks so much. Enjoy your vacation. It's well deserved.
I'm gonna go home and paint a lot of nerd toys.
All right. Thanks.
Bye, everyone.
Thirsty.